You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter, and I get to say it's a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day today.
Sort of.
But it's not going to last, is it?
Prepare for a change in the weather, folks. It's been a dramatic year in so many ways. Actually, it's kind of funny that you say that because I can see clouds rolling in here in Solano County, and the sky is about half cloudy where we are. But right now, according to the National Weather Service in Davis, it's sunny and 59 degrees on April 8th, 2026. For preparing the show for broadcast April 9th, 2026. We'll be going up to a high today of 81 degrees, and it will be sunny today.
It's been like that for the last 3 days. It's been beautiful.
Spectacular spring weather here. I mean, it's really been lovely. And tonight's low, 53. Thursday is going to be 76 and only partly sunny. Here's the change in the weather. Thursday night, there's a chance of rain, and the low is going to be 54 degrees. Friday, showers are likely, and the high is only going to be 67 degrees.
67?
We're just getting going. Friday night, showers are likely, and a chance of rain, 51 degrees. Saturday, showers likely, 66 degrees. Saturday night, chance of rain, 46 degrees. Sunday, 46. Sunday, 62 degrees will be the high with a chance of showers. And Sunday night, the low is going to be 42 degrees.
So it's too early to plant my tomatoes, isn't it? Oh my goodness. People are so confused this spring.
Throw up my hands and say, do whatever you want. Monday's high will be 68. Monday night will be 45, and Tuesday will be 72. As we've said before, my least concern is the tomato plants. More concerned about peppers, eggplants. Certainly don't want you putting in melons or things like that at this point. I've been watching the soil temperature bumped up where we wanted it to be for, you know, almost a week there. That was great. All the metrics were in place. Now it's back down, colder than we like it. But this is a pretty dramatic change in the weather coming. According to the National Weather Service, the discussion goes as follows. Ensemble guidance, looking at the models, supports a pattern change to troughing rain for late week and over the weekend, bringing along a renewal of cooler and what they like to call active weather to the region. There's active weather and passive weather, apparently. High temperatures will be cooler and more seasonable for early to mid-April. In the 60s to 70s in the valley and foothills, 50s to 60s in the mountains, the threat for thunderstorms, this is the important part for gardeners, is on track over the coming days. On Wednesday and into the overnight, the threat is mainly over the northern Sacramento Valley, like Redding. Chances becoming more widespread for thunderstorms across the whole forecast area by Thursday and Friday. There is potential for some severe storms. Saturday and Sunday, we'll see some lingering chances for thunderstorms. Thing to remember, thunderstorms are often accompanied by hail, which is not good for plants. They didn't say that. I did. Showers are forecast as well, along with some mountain snow showers by the weekend as snow levels lower to below the pass. Right now, there's about a 50% chance of snowfall greater than 6 inches above 6,000 feet. I would note it will be falling onto basically bare ground at this point, since the snowpack is pretty much gone. Precipitation looks to become more showery and begin to taper off later in the weekend into early Monday. We have a pretty dramatic change, and if you really want to read the full details of it, my absolute favorite climatologist blog is Daniel Swain's weatherwest.com, whose headline posted last night, after an historically hot March, an active April weather pattern will bring thunderstorms, cooler temperatures, and likely even some Sierra snow. April is not shaping up to be like March in the West, says Dr. Swain. Fortunately, despite the warm start, as the sections below describe, it is shaping up to be a much more active month. Storm activity-wise, temperatures will alternate between warm and cool, as opposed to being stuck seemingly at the very top of the thermometer for weeks on end. He says, I'm sitting here late on Tuesday evening trying to get this blog post out because the next 3 days will likely feature some very interesting and unusual weather across much of Northern California. Wednesday afternoon, a slow-moving cutoff low-pressure system will drift towards the coastline. This will be associated with a modest subtropical tap of moisture. Perhaps more notably, will drift into what is already an exceptionally warm air mass when it hits the land. The combination of very warm and moist near-surface air, by California standards, he notes, somewhat colder air aloft, and a favorable cyclonically curved upper-level flow pattern over Northern California will bring increasing potential for thunderstorm activity each afternoon from Wednesday into Friday. Highest chance of thunderstorms will be over the northern Sacramento Valley, northern coast ranges, and northern Sierra foothills by Thursday and Friday. Potential for widespread thunderstorm activity encompassing the entire Central Valley, much of the San Francisco Bay Area, and all of the Northern California mountains. There will probably be at least a couple, perhaps more than a couple, severe thunderstorms, including an isolated photogenic supercell or two somewhere over Northern California during that period. And the highest odds will be in the Central Valley. We've got a rather dramatic period coming up here for weather. And the only real relevance of this to us, other than the temperature,
hail, that'll be relevant.
Hail. And the reason hail is relevant, aside from the direct injury that it can do to plants, you know, if you've got little seedlings out there in your vegetable garden, they can get hit by hailstones, they can be pretty badly tattered. The leaf injury can be a problem for tomatoes in particular. I just want to mention this because if you get leaf injury from hail, which it does, it strikes the leaf and it causes a damage to the protective cuticle, you'll frequently see bacterial or fungal diseases enter through that point of injury. So if you have had a problem and you're in a region where late blight or septorial leaf spot or even early blight are typically an issue on your tomatoes, this is how it starts, is the injury to the leaf, the injury to the stem, combined with rain and wind splashing spores around, and those spores will alight on the leaf and find that point of entry. The one thing you could do, at least in theory, if you're concerned about this, is go ahead and cover over your newly planted plants with something that blocks them from that kind of hail. Bear in mind, though, that thunderstorms tend to come in with a great deal of wind. So whatever you put down should be securely attached. One of the
simplest, it'll flatten your plants.
It will flatten, right. It will go right over and take the plants with it. One of the simplest things is seedling blanket, sometimes sold as frost blanket, the same basic material, could be put in over the plants as long as it's weighted down in a number of places. That would have two advantages. One, it would warm things up a little bit underneath that blanket during the daytime, help warm the soil up and reduce the slightly adverse impact of these colder temperatures, but also could prevent leaf injury. Don't leave it on there too long or else you'll just make things worse, but leaving it on during the period of thunderstorms, as long as it's securely battened down, as they say, could help protect you from some of those leaf and stem diseases. Other than that, I'm not too concerned about this weather, and it would be nice to get some actual rainfall to moisten the soil. A few days ago, we only got, I think right before the last week's show, we'd had about a tenth of an inch here. I know on the other side of the valley, people got over an inch in some places. We haven't had significant enough rainfall to make any difference for the irrigation needs of your lawn, shrubs, newly planted plants for quite some time. So continue your hand watering. Keep an eye on how much rainfall we get from this storm, but it sounds like it's going to be more hazard than benefit in some ways for the newly planted plants. If you haven't got them in the ground, you might want to keep them up close to the house. I brought home, just so you all know, 6 tomato plants yesterday.
You're not going to plant them today, are you?
I was actually going to plant them today.
But you're not going to plant
them. I'm not going to plant them today. No, I got on.
Not until after the hail is gone.
Right. I was thinking, you know what? I'll do a little experiment. I have a new area that I've opened up. I have room for some more tomatoes. I'll give these a try, put them in early, see what happens. I'm going to wait until early next week until we get past this thunderstorm. I'd suggest you do the same. But, you know, as I say, do what you want. KDRT is community radio. That's public radio. We rely on contributions from listeners like you to fund our operating costs. If you like what you hear, head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. And here at KDRT, we do have lots of great programming. We always like to mention another show, just in case you haven't found it yet. Head on over to 95.7 FM on your dial if you're within the city limits of Davis. And if you're live, you know, listen to the live stream, it's kdrt.org. If you're into sports, there's a program called Eye on Sports. talk radio show focused on local sports in the Sacramento-Davis area, occasionally covers national sports. Hosts Chuck and Cody have been involved with sporting both nationally and locally for more than 15 years, want to share their opinions, initiate discussion of the public through conversation, and occasional outside interviews. This show will not be politically driven in any way, they say. The conversation will cover the results, local impact, business, and psychology of sports. Our goal is to create a lighthearted, focused conversation on everything sports-related. That's live Thursdays, 6 to 7 p.m. Replay Saturdays, 7 to 8 a.m. right here on KDRT.
Okay, so we've got a couple of events that we know about and want to tell you about. First is the Gardens Gone Native Garden Tours, and this is coming up on Saturday, April 18th and Sunday, April 19th from 9:30 a.m. to 3 p.m. And there are 45 gardens in the Sacramento area that you go and visit. It's amazing. So anyway, this is something that you might look for. And
I want to mention the plants are labeled, apparently. There are rules for this tour. Oh, yeah. I only know this secondhand by reading on various, Facebook groups of the Native Plant Society. Someone was commenting that they had submitted their list of plants, and then the folks at CNPS had put different common names on some of them. And I thought, wow, so they actually have a detailed and a rules-based list for the plant materials at these California Native Plant Society gardens. So it's not just a bunch of pretty plants that are in a place that give you ideas. There's information, and you can take pictures of the labels, and the labels will correspond to the descriptions at calscape.org.
All right.
Okay.
The other thing that we have that I want to tell you about has absolutely nothing to do with plants. But the Senior Center here in town, is every year they have a jewelry sale. People in the community bring in the jewelry that they no longer are going to use. They donate it to the Senior Center. The Senior Center turns around, evaluates it, prices it, and then has a two-day sale. The sale itself is Friday, May 1st. And Saturday, May 2nd, from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. each day. All right, this is from Gordon. Good morning. I have a few questions I would like to have the answers to. Information online is not particularly informative.
You noticed that, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So here are his four questions. Start with, I know that when rooting cuttings, you always put the bottom end into the rooting medium or into the water. Does this apply to philodendrons that have many root nodes along their stems?
The node needs to be covered. It doesn't matter whether the cutting itself is vertical or horizontal. There were plants when I worked in the Botanical Conservancy, which is what we now call it. It was called the Botany Greenhouses back then. One of our main jobs was propagating plant materials to have available for different labs and for different purposes, maintain interesting collections. Some things were done from seed and so forth, but a lot were done from cuttings. Some of them were done from leaves. And sometimes the cutting, we would just put it horizontally into a flat of rooting mediums, like a Dieffenbachia is a good example. And that's in the philodendron family. Dieffenbachias, if you've gotten one that's gotten way too tall and you want to cut it down, you now have a massive propagule. You'll have every node can potentially root and grow. And rather than chop it into a bunch of cuttings and stick them into something, we would often lie them down horizontally onto a solid propagation flat about halfway into the medium, which would be a mix of peat moss and perlite, or perlite and vermiculite, or some combination of those things. And we would let them root out from the node. And generally speaking, right from the same place it would root out, it would start to grow a new shoot. We could then look at that log that was lying there in the flat and decide whether we now wanted to cut it into two or three pieces and already rooted and growing and separate them out that way, or just plant it out whole. So it is not essential that it stick down in the manner you're thinking of. It can root out from any node. You could put it in upside down and it would probably root just fine. The new growing point would come up and it will orient itself as needed. We generally do them obviously vertically for convenience and because that's the natural growth habit of the plant. But to your question, no, they don't absolutely need to be done in the manner that you see them typically done. Things like roses, plants like that, we almost always are going to stick them in the way I've just described. Let me tell you how we do rose cuttings at our garden center. We're growing the majority of our own roses now from cuttings. We take them, we cut them into 12 to 16 inch lengths. We make sure there's at least 2 to 3 nodes down in the rooting medium. We practically bundle them together and we stick them all together in one pot, like way too close together. We do this to conserve space. As soon as they callus near the node and begin to initiate roots, which are just little bumps, we then spread them out. And the ones that haven't started to do that, we throw them out. That's the purpose of doing them this close together. Then we spread them out into individual pots and grow them on that way. So we're crowding them very close together. We're going vertically. One, because that's how the plant is going to grow. But two, the main reason being it saves us some space. So there's a lot of things that are done in plant propagation more for convenience, for production efficiency than necessarily for the absolute requirement of the plant.
Okay, so that's philodendrons and roses. Yep. I have an angel wing begonia, which I don't know if people are familiar with it, but it has a root mass down at the bottom, and then it has canes coming straight up. And if you break off a cane, it will immediately form a new cane at the next node down. I mean, it's a very vigorous plant.
You can cut them back hard with no problem. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. And you can take any one of those shoots that's up there and cut it down and stick it back in the soil and it'll grow. It's amazing.
And you could put them on their side if you wanted to, if there was some reason to do that. But generally speaking, we just dip that node in the rooting hormone, which really does make a big difference. I can verify that. And then we'll stick it straight up and down into whatever we're rooting in. We don't absolutely have to do it that way. No, you could do it horizontally if there's some reason to do that.
So on your roses, you're cutting off chunks of roses so there's no leaves or anything. But on what I'm talking about, there are still leaves to support the cane.
There very commonly are leaves on the rose cuttings because we do them at all times of year. And this is something that most people don't realize. We can, in a greenhouse with a mist bench, like we have, you can do rose cuttings essentially any time of year. And you can do other cuttings essentially any time of year. When we do begonias, like your cane begonias, like you're describing, we will take them. We cut the leaves. I learned this in the Botanical Conservancy. We'll cut the leaves in half. Anytime you take a cutting, it's a race against time between the plant withering because it's still using water and forming new roots that'll help it take up water. So essentially, you have a plant that's dying, and you're trying to get it to root and grow before it dies. And if you have big leafy tropical leaves, it's pumping water with no way to continue taking them up. If there are a webcam showing what I'm doing right now, the dramatic way my hands are flinging around would be causing you to laugh. That's why we do this on the radio. But we would cut those leaves in half to reduce evapotranspiration, to reduce the loss of water.
Petiole to tip or half?
It technically doesn't make the slightest difference, but we would typically cut them in half just to reduce the total leaf volume. Doesn't matter, but we would cut them in half. It doesn't matter, actually. So we would just cut them in. Okay. We're just reducing leaf area is the main purpose. And the purpose of that is to reduce the water loss. But we wanted to leave some leaves on there because they're photosynthesizing and it helps create new roots. So our compromise to reduce water loss through the leaves but help stimulate root production was to cut the leaves in half. To your question, if the leaf is pointing away from you, we would cut perpendicular to that, if that makes any sense, but it doesn't really matter. The idea is just to reduce the water loss through the leaf. And also, we then cover over it. The guy who does most of our propagation developed this thing over the mist bench where he could just drop down frost blanket, seedling blanket over the whole bench for the first 7 to 10 days while these plants are rooting in. So we're doing everything we can to keep moisture up, reduce evapotranspiration, and hope those roots start to grow before the cutting withers and dies. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. People will bring us roses. Sometimes they root beautifully. Sometimes some varieties just won't root at all. Commonly, they've kept them too long before they brought them to us, so rehydrating them can be an issue. In that instance, we plunge them in water till they're literally submerged in water. We take them out, we make a fresh new cut, and then we get them into the new medium as fast as we possibly can. If you happen to be doing roses, this is also really important, inspect the leaves very carefully for fungus diseases, or else you're going to just be carrying rust and downy mildew right on through your propagation system into your production system. So inspect very carefully. It's best if, in the case of roses, if you do that outside of your greenhouse, near the trash can, and take all those leaves off and dispose of them before they even go into the production system, because that's one of the common ways that diseases are spread, unfortunately, is on propagation materials.
All right, number two, when watering plants, is it harmful to use leftover canned water? Don and I had a discussion about what leftover canned water meant. And what it is it's usually carbonated and has some flavor, but no sugars. So it's just water and natural flavor and carbonation.
Seltzer water.
It's also, yeah, stuff that humans can drink.
Not to be confused with soda water.
Which is water with soda in it?
Presumably with the soda, there's some kind of salt in there. So I don't know for okay. sure. But seltzer water is just fizzy That's water. It.
So if the ingredients on the bottle or the case says water and national flavors and that's it, is it okay?
Yeah, absolutely fine. Yep.
Okay. Yep. And there's no benefit from carbonation in
the well, water. Let's get to the next question.
Okay. Third, does peroxide have any beneficial use in houseplants? When reading about it online, it seems to imply that it has the same benefits as rubbing alcohol. Supposedly, it will control fungus gnats in the soil, as well as scale and mealybug. It is also mentioned as a seed treatment, although it did not say what the treatment was for.
Seed treatment is an interesting one.
Hold on. Garden. Gordon. Stop reading online.
No, that's fine. Look,
Googling something is not the way to go.
Well, it's a good
Look
start.
For the actual garden shows.
Like well, or add.edu to any yep. search query you do. But there was a product for a long time, might still be out there for all I know, called Oxygen Plus. This was a fertilizer that we were supposed to sell at garden centers. And by the way, it sold like crazy. It was a 2% nitrogen, which is pretty low, and it had a little bit of phosphorus and a little bit of potassium in it, and they'd added hydrogen peroxide to this fertilizer solution you could buy. It was right there on the shelf next to Marsh's VF11, Schultz's Instant, Miracle-Gro, which was new at the time, and Oxygen Plus. And their claim was it would, quote, prevent overwatering, end quote. We got good laughs about that at nursery trade shows and things like that. How is Oxygen Plus, how is hydrogen peroxide preventing overwatering? And their rationale was that it would introduce oxygen into the root zone, which I guess is hypothetically possible. Whether that would make even the slightest difference in the functioning of the water molds that cause the damage from watering too frequently, I have no idea. They certainly didn't present any efficacy data, but there was nothing wrong with the idea. And plenty of people were taking Oxygen Plus, buying it, following the label directions, feeding their plants with it, and getting good results. Why? Because it was 2% nitrogen. It was a plant food. So plant food is fine. And the oxygen part, the hydrogen peroxide, we know is at least harmless, but we don't know whether it was presenting the touted benefits. Let's put it that way. A little bit of overselling going on there. Hydrogen peroxide is, in fact, being touted online on various non-EDU sites for control of different things. There's no way that it would have any effect on insects unless you drown them in it. So, I mean, I suppose you could take a Q-tip, just like you do with rubbing alcohol, and use that to kill a mealybug or kill a scale or something like that. I doubt if hydrogen peroxide would even kill a scale, frankly. It might kill a mealybug. Let's stick to conventional methods for those. You know, rinse them off. There are safe insecticides you can use, or if you're like my mom, you can use that rubbing alcohol, isopropyl alcohol on a Q-tip for your mealybugs on your cactus or succulents. The claims aren't evidenced. So I'll put it that way. The only thing I can... No, it's not harmful. You know, we get back to my basic dictum that I've modified from Dr. Linda Chalker Scott, which is when you're presented with a gardening product or practice, you ask two questions. Is it necessary? Is it harmful? Hydrogen peroxide is neither necessary nor harmful. So as far as I'm concerned, you're not hurting anything by using it, but any claims about its efficacy for fungus control, bacterial control, or insect control are not evidence. I'll put it that way.
Okay, so Gordon's last question for today's message, at least, is I have a citrus plant that dried up while I was away for 10 days.
Yeah.
When I came back, all the leaves were crispy dead and fell off a couple of days later.
Yeah.
2 weeks later, and the stems all appear to be green still. Is there a chance that it may regenerate? And if so, how can I help it? It gets very good morning sunlight. And this was sent in mid-March.
And so important to note, Gordon's in Montreal, Canada. So if your citrus outside here has dropped its leaves, and we have had some comments about that, it was related to temperatures in this area, really related to the cold fog that we had back in November, December. We actually had some citrus dropping a bunch of leaves because of that. Gordon is in Montreal, so these are not outside. They would be dead. He's growing them as indoor plants. And we have pictures, actually, of his setup from a while back where he was growing them under lights in the winter. You are able to resurrect citrus from severe drought in most cases if you catch it in time. They will form an abscission layer, drop a lot of leaves. As long as the stems are still green and limber, that plant is still alive and has the ability to regenerate, put out some new growth. So it is a very high likelihood, if you get it under the brightest light you have and keep the temperatures up on it, that it will put out some new growth. Don't be surprised if it also puts out some flower buds. One, they're already formed and ready to go. Two, plants that are panicking or very stressed often bloom as a response to stress. So don't be shocked by that. Also, don't be shocked if they don't set fruit properly, but you could get some new growth. The next question I typically would get is, should I feed it? Unless there's leaves growing, there isn't much point in that. So I would wait and see, water carefully and correctly, and keep it as warm and bright as you can. Once new growth does begin, I would feed it with whatever your preferred liquid fertilizer is. And I mentioned liquid in this case because it's just going to be faster acting. So any of those soluble fertilizers that you prefer to use will be fine. The main thing you're after is nitrogen. I think there's a good chance 10 days wasn't too long. If it's still limber, still green, then there's a pretty good chance it will come back. To that same topic, with people coming in right now to my nursery who say bought a bare root tree and isn't leafing out, they're wondering if it's dead. There's a really simple test you can use anytime you're curious about whether a plant is alive or dead. The thumbnail test. Scratch the bark with your thumbnail. If it's green underneath, it's alive. If it's gray underneath or tan, at least that part where you scratched it is probably dead. But remember our famous dictum here, where there's protoplasm, there is hope.
I had not heard that one, Don. Where there is protoplasm, there is hope.
I'm going to make a bumper sticker.
Yeah. Well, Don always says this thumbnail test. And I always imagine in my mind someone going, well, let's see if that one's alive, and going and scraping the stem, the great big stem right in the middle. I was like, come on, man, start with a branch.
Doesn't
start
matter.
With a branch, see if that's done.
But, do it wherever you want. Don't worry about it.
Well, won't that damage the plant, though, Don? If you
an injury on the stem hypothetically could be a point of disease entry, but you know, plants get injured on the stem all the time. They get things whacking them, they get nails put in them to put signs up, and they can heal. So they're capable of healing. I'm not too concerned about it. The main question is, where is the plant going to resprout from? And if you want to figure that out, start high, scratch the bark, not green there. Okay, go down a foot, scratch the bark there, go down a foot. It's a really simple test. I agree. We don't want to be constantly making injuries on the stems. I used to have young men that lived on this property that couldn't walk by a tree without whacking it with a stick. And they were very amused that I was always yelling at them not to do that. And I said, it's a living thing.
And now they like plants.
It's a living thing. Be nice to it. And they would go, it doesn't hurt the plant. See, it looks fine. And I would figure that maybe this wasn't something to make an issue.
Yeah, choose your battles.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Choose your battles with adolescence.
Yeah.
Okay. So Gordon, I would point out, Gordon is in Montreal. How's the weather in Montreal for planting?
Well, he writes, P.S. Planting date here is usually mid to late May, so we will be starting our tomato plants from seed pretty soon. Outdoors, friendly.
I pulled up the Pierre Elliott Trudeau International Airport Station, Montreal, where the weather right now, the temperature right now is 37, and it says, feels like 29.
37 is the high for the day, folks.
I think they're going up to 42. Ah, there we
42.
Go.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's above freezing. Things will melt.
Interacting with nurseries all across the country, as I do on a particular Facebook group, most of them aim to open by Mother's Day. I'm talking about the Midwest, Upper Midwest, Mid-Atlantic, New England, you know, pretty much the rest of
it. That's the second Sunday in May.
Right. And that's just mainly to get people in buying flowers and things like that. These are mostly greenhouse operations. So you can go into them to buy things. They're showing pictures of these beautiful hanging baskets they have underway with petunias and verbenas and calibrachoa, lots of color. They're ready to sell hundreds of hanging baskets and bedding plants and things like that. But that, I've asked, that doesn't really begin the sales of that kind of stuff, their real peak of the season, until about Memorial Day weekend. And then they have 3 to 4 weeks of absolutely insane business. And then it's summer and the bugs are out. So it's a fairly intense season in the nursery business in those colder climates, because they just wait and wait and wait. And then they have that pent up demand that we were going through here in the second week of March. That usually happens in late May in places like that. Good to hear from you, Gordon. Good luck with your citrus.
And he sent us a photo. I love this photo. Thank you, Gordon. He's a second looking out a second floor window. Every tree, except the evergreens, I think there's some pines back there. Every tree is totally bare. The ground is covered in snow. The roadways are clear, and you can see there's a shovel leaning up against them because we know he's been at. Well, the next one's not happy, but I think it's necessary. Okay. Don, what are our fungus diseases here in Davis this spring?
At this time of year, with the rain we had a week ago, such as it was, and at that time, some warmer temperatures, we're seeing three major diseases on rose bushes in particular. They all kind of came at once this year. So the sequence that we get, and you can find information about this at redwoodbarn.com. I don't have to go into a lot of detail. Downy mildew is the first one that causes what look like black spots on the leaves. People often think it's black spot disease. That's not our big deal here. Downy mildew usually shows up first with the rain, causes a lot of defoliation. So it hits the leaf, it runs into the petiole, that leaf drops off. I like to describe it as a self-limiting disease. The infected leaf falls to the ground. You get in there, rake all that out. You get out of the infectious period. That one solves itself. Rust. Rust is that orange, gross stuff that's on the underside of the leaf. And the top of the leaf looks like it has a lot of little yellow spots that correspond to the placement of the rust pustule or fungus on the underside of the leaf. You can rub it off of the leaf with your thumb, and it's the color of Cheetos cheese puffs. And that's a fungus with a very heavy spore. So if we have that on a rose bush, it either rained a lot or you've got sprinklers running and splashing the spores up higher and higher. Haven't seen a lot of that this year because it was very dry until we got that rain. And now suddenly people are posting pictures of their rust. And the third one is powdery mildew, which is a drier adapted fungus that causes the white coating on the leaves of roses and many other plants. The good news is that the powdery mildew on your roses is not the same species that's on your lilac or another nearby bush. So the fact that one plant has it that's unrelated to your roses doesn't mean your roses are going to get it. They'll get their own powdery mildew. Each of these is a challenge because we don't really have fungicides that are curative anymore. I remember in the 1990s when most of the really effective but also very toxic fungicides went off the market. The manufacturers discontinued them in most cases. We don't have things that cure a fungus once you have it. So if you walk in with mildew and the nursery says, here, spray this to cure that, well, that's not accurate. You use them as preventatives. So the thing they really should say is, cut that all back, cut off the part that's got fungus on it, go ahead and spray with this as a preventative to protect the new growth if you want to do that. But frankly, it's just going to outgrow it. It will outgrow most of these diseases. The one in particular.
And powdery mildew, you can just wash off.
Right. That's one that's not in the leaf. It's on the leaf. It's just on the surface of the leaf. So if when we're telling you to wash off your roses for your aphids, really vigorous rinse will also significantly reduce powdery mildew. The other thing is, in case of roses and certain other plants, there are varietal differences. If one variety just gets it constantly, the one next to it may get none at all. I have a bunch of roses that never get powdery mildew and some nearby that get it pretty consistently. And some of them it's light and not really annoying, and others it's so bad that I look at it and say, I'm going to prune you with a shovel and put in a better rose. That's the approach to bad powdery mildew. But the rust is the one that really bothers people, and good reason. It's gross. The simplest thing I have found to do about rust: enjoy that first big bloom. They're in their early peak of bloom right now. A lot of your roses are just getting there. And then go ahead, I know this sounds extreme, cut it back as if it was January. Just go ahead and do another hard pruning on it. Take all that stuff that you just cut off and send it away. Do not leave it lying on the ground, for sure. Don't just put it in your compost pile. I'm not sure how you would compost rose prunings anyway without grinding them. Send it to the landfill or whatever, green waste pickup bin, thank you, and let them deal with it. Because if it does go through the city's composting process, that'll kill it. That means the temperature of their compost piles has gotten high enough that problem will not be now someone else's problem. But you get that all out of your yard because those great big heavy orange spores will splash back up, especially if you have sprinklers. So if your roses happen to be near your lawn, for example, try to readjust the sprinkler heads so they're not spraying them. And during rust season, March, April, May, water your roses at ground level with drip or soaker hose rather than with overhead sprinkling. For the record, I use overhead watering on my roses very regularly from about mid-May right on through the summer. I do it all the time. It's way more convenient for me to water with a rainbird or an oscillating sprinkler and just let it run for a long time. And I don't care that I'm getting water on the leaves when the humidity is low every day when we're in our normal summer pattern here. So in our climate, you can just cut them back, water at ground level through April and into May. And at that point, you don't have to worry about any of these diseases. Typically, we get so dry and so warm by the middle of May that we typically don't have fungus problems on our roses and many other plants, honestly, right on through the summer here. If you're listening, Montreal, for example, someplace where it actually rains in the summer, you don't want to use overhead watering because it will increase black spot, increase rust, and possibly increase downy mildew. I'm not as familiar with the life cycles of your fungus diseases in colder climates, but I know you have all the same diseases. So there, overhead watering, even through the summer, would be a problem. Sacramento Valley, interior Southern California, is typically not an issue. Coastal California, usually not as much of a problem, but perhaps water earlier in the day.
You said something about there's different kinds of rusts on different kinds of plants.
Yeah.
Do we have plants that will get rust in the spring that aren't roses?
Yes, snapdragons come to mind. Hollyhocks can get rust very badly. And I don't need to say this, fellow nursery people, it's our fault when they do. It's not the customer's fault. That was on the seedling when you grew it. Yeah, I've grown hollyhocks and snapdragons from seed. We like to sell them, and we check the seedling flat as soon as they come up because rust is a heavy but sticky fungal spore. It attaches itself to the seed. It was on the seed when you planted it, and it immediately infects the new seedling. You shouldn't just pinch that off or try to spray it with something. You should throw it away. This is to the growers out there. We threw away 4 flats of hollyhock seedlings one year because all of the seed that we got was contaminated with rust fungus. It's very hard for them to keep it out. I don't know if anybody that's going to do inspections of hollyhock seeds before they go out. I'd have to pay a lot more for the seed if they were doing that. So you just inspect the seedlings, monitor them. I have occasionally gotten a flat where there's only 1 or 2 leaves. I'll pick those off. We put a little flag on that flat. We monitor really carefully. That's the key because snapdragons and hollyhocks in particular, which are very popular with home gardeners, especially snapdragons, that's how it started on your plants, was on a seedling that you planted. From your standpoint as a consumer, when you're looking at those 6 packs of snapdragons or those plants that they're selling, and they're really popular, even at Walmart and places like that, just tip the plant over, look at the undersides of the leaves, any orange spots on there, don't buy that plant.
So if I were growing hollyhocks at my house and I liked them, could I just harvest my own seeds and plant those? And if it didn't have rust, then it wouldn't have rust?
If the plant doesn't have rust, then the seed won't have rust. That's right. It came from the plant onto the seed. So that's the first thing. And most people who plant hollyhocks find they only need to do it once. They see themselves
if
quite a bit.
If they're in a place where they're going to grow well.
Yeah,
They
can take a fair bit of shade. Full sun is better. Hollyhocks are really easy to grow. The question came up at one point, what do you do if you get rust on your hollyhocks? And I said, it's really simple, just like on your snapdragons. Take them all out. Wait 2 or 3 months before you plant again. Then you'll probably be free of rust. But check the plants when you buy them.
Yeah. Okay. And then we have a few other things going on in spring, don't we? When is fire blight season?
It's here right now. I got my first picture of it a week ago, but then our temperatures dipped down below the optimal range for fire blight. Amusingly, the perfect range for fire blight is pretty much the same temperature range for planting tomatoes, 55 to 85 degrees. You want some phenological phenomenon for planting your tomatoes? Watch for fire blight. That's a good starting point.
Oh, that would be an interesting one.
Yeah, sort of a negative way to look at it, but I suppose it would work. Fire blight hits when the pyracanthus and the apple trees are blooming. Most of the apple trees, it is, it co-evolved with members of Rosaceae, particularly the palm branch of the rose family, pome, P-O-M-E, referring to the apples and their relatives. Apples, pears, quince, pyracantha, hawthorn are the particular ones that get fire blight. I've also seen it on photinia, occasionally on toyon, but not often enough to be concerned about it. Photinia can be a real problem when it happens, actually. And it's a bacterial disease that has a pretty specific temperature range. As I said, 55 to 82 degrees is the exact range I remember from plant pathology. Requires not just high moisture, but bees to carry it from blossom to blossom, or rain to splash it from point to point. Bees are the most common source, and particularly on your apples and your pyracanthus and things like that. We'll generally see it from early April till early May, sometimes into mid-May. Once we get above 85 degrees, just a couple days in a row, that usually is the end of the fire blight infectious period. My standard recommendation now, if you see fire blight, I just wait it out, wait till we're out of the infection period, getting into June or anytime through the summer and fall, you can then prune it out. It's really obvious where it is. I prefer not to prune it while it's continuing to actively infect. At least in theory, it could infect through the pruning cuts. That seems to be a fairly slight chance, but it's certainly a possibility. More to the point, it's still infecting. So let's just let it run its course, wait and see how bad it is, prune it out. In the long run, in most cases, pears, things like that, your best bet is to look for a resistant variety like Warren, Fanstill, Moonglow. In case of Pyracantha, if anybody's still planting Pyracantha, the variety Santa Cruz is quite resistant to fire blight, so they say. And in the case of apples, you're kind of on your own because the charts are very complicated. But fire blight is a fast-moving, frustrating bacterial disease that infects plants that are susceptible to it. It can do a lot of damage, so we tend to stay away from those. But the basic answer is pruning it out. Nothing is really labeled for that works for home gardeners. That's the simple answer when it comes to fire blight.
Ilya writes, hi, Don and Lois. I really enjoyed your discussion of various trumpet vines. You have a hedge made of 6 Irish lucky bushes. Now, Don, you looked that up. What is an Irish lucky bush?
We run into this where people ask about a particular plant by the varietal name. And Irish luck is a particular cultivar of Pittosporum. We're just talking about that. Tenuifolium, which is a different species of Pittosporum. Just for the record, I first learned to say it Pittosporum. Then I moved to Northern California, and people up here say Pittosporum. So I've gradually morphed over into that. You can say
it either
way.
Yeah, I haven't gotten there yet.
Neither is correct or incorrect. It's fine either way. But Pittosporum tenuifolium, the variety Irish luck, which is just a improved selection of, I believe it's a dwarf one, of Pittosporum, which is a very popular evergreen shrub used for hedges.
So Pittosporum that I'm used to, we called mock orange. Is mock orange a part of this
mock orange
thing, or is that different?
No, that's Pittosporum tobira. And to my way of thinking, that's the only one that's suitable in the interior. No, Ilya is over on the coast. So actually, there's a lot of Pittosporum that do well in California's coastal climates. Pittosporum tobira is commonly actually just called tobira. That's the common name a lot of people use. But in California, we also call that mock orange. They're blooming now. They've been blooming for about 2 weeks. They smell wonderfully like lemon blossoms. One of the most widely planted plants in the state for a bunch of reasons, primarily the dwarf versions like Wheeler's Dwarf. But the regular form is a fantastic background plant. I have one that's literally 20 feet tall, about 20 feet across. It's about 35 years old because I've trained it up like a tree, which you can do. The variegated form is popular and grows a little more slowly. So a lot of people like to grow that one as a shrub, and it's a very popular hedge plant. But Ilya is referring to Pittosporum tenuifolium. This is grown more in the coastal zones, and people come in and ask me about these here. There's a bunch of varieties. There's a chronic dieback problem that we get in the valley on Pittosporum tenuifolium, Pittosporum eugenioides, and Pittosporum crassifolium. Those are 3 different species in the same genus that are widely sold in garden centers, particularly in the coastal areas. People plant them here. They grow fine, and then a branch will die, and then another branch will die. And the plant is fine. You just prune that out. And that's easy enough to manage that way. But when people ask me about this, I say, there's no control. You're just going to have to keep doing this. So if that bothers you, this wouldn't be my first choice of a plant because this dieback issue, it's a fungal disease. It's probably a Botrytis firia type of organism causes this dieback. So we aren't going to see this in the valley. It doesn't hit Pittosporum tobira. Short, long answer, short question, as usual. Go ahead.
Well, we haven't even gotten to our question.
I know.
A long diversion for a short question. All right. So she's got 6 Irish luck bushes planted as a hedge. They are doing okay in their eternal struggle with resident gophers.
Yeah.
I am wondering about an idea I have to plant a trumpet vine in between the 6 large hedge bushes so the vines can go onto their structure and hopefully bloom through the monotony of green leaves of the Irish luck plant. Please share your thoughts on this idea.
Well, it depends on the trumpet vine. We talked about the really rampant ones, you know, some of the ones that are really problematic last time, but there are other plants called trumpet vine that are not as overwhelming. I don't want people planting Campsis radicans, the trumpet creeper, without knowing that it just suckers all over the place and becomes a bit of a nightmare. But there's one of the trumpet vine plants that we're selling a lot of here because it's well-mannered and evergreen and has blooms off and on through the summer is Pandorea. Pandorea, once again, the species name is Jasminoides. seems to be the species name for about 10 different vines. That just means the plant looks like a jasmine. It's not a jasmine. It doesn't smell like a jasmine, but Jasminoides is the species name. And it's a sometimes called bower vine. Hate to say this. There's two other plants that are also called bower vine. So Pandorea jasminoides is a very well-mannered. In our area, gets to about 10 to 15 feet, twines on things, will tangle up on itself if you let it, but happily twines up on a trellis or a we often would use concrete wire when we were installing vines as landscapers. We would just get 6-foot concrete wire, same thing I used to make tomato cages. We would cut that sharp. This is something that has to be done carefully. We would attach it to the fence with brads, attaching it to the 4x4 posts, and it would create a very light but sturdy trellis that had just enough of a gap between it and the fence that a vine that twines, like a Pandorea, could climb up on it. Any vine is going to run to the top, just straight up, no matter what. So it is up to you, if you want the density, to kind of spread those branches out and tie them horizontally to try to get sufficient cover. But a single Pandorea jasminoides will cover about an 8-foot section of fence within one summer or two, depending on your climate, your soil. So that's one possibility. And it's very well-mannered, has a summer bloom. It's just a fragrant flower, but not annoyingly fragrant. You walk up to it to smell it, not.
And is this one that you don't have to cut back every year? You can just let it go?
Yeah.
Or is this one that only blooms on the end twigs and you'd be having bare branches in the middle?
Eventually, any vine is going to get bare down at the bottom, especially if it's behind a hedge. So keep that in mind. So it'll mostly be up on the top of your structure, but it will bloom throughout the fabric of the vine, if that's what you're asking. And it's just a very well-mannered vine, and it's evergreen, whereas the trumpet creeper is deciduous. So of the trumpet-like flowered vines, that would be one of my preferred ones. Now, those of you outside of zones, let's say 9B and 10, this is going to be too tender for you, but it is something that grows very well here.
So you were saying structure, meaning there's a fence and you've got some wires holding
something. Yeah.
When I read this, I read planted in between the 6 large hedge bushes so the vines can go on their structure, meaning the structure of the hedge.
Well, you could do that.
Climb through the hedge.
Yeah, that could be asking for trouble down the road. Plants that twine onto shrubs pretty much become just, let's just say they engulf it and that's the end of it. So yeah, if it's a twining vine or something vigorous like that, putting it where it could happily climb onto the shrubs itself would concern me. I would have it climb onto the fence as a structure, not the shrubs itself. The vines that I would use if it's behind a shrub would not be true vines. They'd be the big sprawling things that you tie up, like bougainvillea, tecomeria, tachoma, Solanum rancinetii. We can back up and go through some of these, but they're not twiners. They don't hold by tendrils. They don't root into things. They're just big arching. Again, if there were a cam here, you could see me making these great gestures with my hands and arms. Big arching, sprawling plants that then flop forward and give you blooms typically at the end of that growth. So it would be bougainvillea is probably the best known one in California. It's not a vine, but we grow it like a vine. Tecomeria capensis, the Cape honeysuckle, 15-foot plant, blooms out at the end, bright orange honeysuckle-like flowers, and very, very attractive to hummingbirds, by the way, but doesn't root into things, doesn't grab onto things. You just have to decide how you're going to hold it up there, because otherwise it'll just sprawl all over everything else. The purple potato vine, Solanum rancinetii. Taxonomists have moved it to Lysianthus. Solanum rancinetii, purple potato vine, same thing. Big sprawling plant, royal purple flowers from about midsummer through the fall. In our area, they freeze back. Where Ilia is, they probably wouldn't. They would probably stay green through the winter time. But this is not a vine. It's just a great big arching shrubby thing. So you're using it because of that. You're tying it up onto the fence. It's simple enough. You don't even have to have a structure for it if you don't want to. And then it's back there providing that privacy. Now, one that I'll mention that's a vigorous vine that would give you the privacy but wouldn't typically be real long-lived, so you might be waiting for the shrubs to grow up. We get into this. Someone wants privacy. They're planting a little 5-gallon plant that's only 2 feet tall, and their neighbor has an ugly thing, and they want to screen that off. Hardenbergia, which is not a trumpet vine, but the lilac vine, we've sold it for many years. We've had occasionally years where it gets cold enough to damage it here in the valley, interestingly, but typically it's come through just fine. It's very vigorous, grows to 8 to 10 feet in a single season, lots of leafy stuff from the base. So it tends to provide the density that you're after. It will scramble over pretty much anything nearby, but it doesn't root sucker. It doesn't twine on things and make a big mess that way. The thing is, our experience with it has been 4 to 5 years in, the plant will typically die. And so we want people to understand this is a short-lived screen, great for that purpose. And for planting behind a hedge, you probably couldn't come up with anything better because it's dying back as your shrub is growing up and providing the privacy. And it's pretty easy to get out at that point. Hardenbergia, Violacea, Happy Wanderer, nurseries in the Bay Area certainly sell it. We sell it here because of the wintertime bloom. So that peak bloom is past, but it's a popular one for that purpose. One plant that I'm using for this purpose right now is not a vine. It's a sprawling shrub called plumbago. You've probably seen it with the pale blue flower. And I have a short fence that I just wanted something vine-like. It didn't have to be a vine. And so I planted the blue-flowered Cape plumbago right on the fence. And it will go up the top of that with no problem. And it will, I will tie it across to cover the area that I'm after. It'll bloom all summer into the fall. We do get some freeze damage on it here, mostly just partial defoliation more than anything. And it comes right back from that. So that's another possibility of a scrambling shrub that could be used like a vine. Plumbago capensis. Notice this capensis is a common part of these names. They're from the Cape of South Africa.
Well, back to the mailbag. Ilya has a second part to her email. She said, due to some plumbing challenges in the kitchen, I began to dump coffee water and grinds from the day's coffee pot, a French press, in the vicinity of camellias that grow outside my kitchen door. I noticed an improvement in leaf color and general perky stand of the plants. Could it be true what they say on the internet about coffee grinds and plants? Or is just extra watering doing the trick? Well, many thanks for your answer in advance. Your loyal listener, Ilya in Tiburon.
So coffee grounds do have nitrogen in them. It's basically a light fertilizer. It's kind of tied up in them, so it's not quickly available. There's nothing wrong with coffee grounds in the garden, if that's the question. There was kind of a fad, I don't know, 5-10 years ago, people going around to all the Peet's and Starbucks and places, and some of those places would actually, you know, give away buckets and buckets of coffee grounds. So at some point, there could be an excess. But going online to a .edu site, I thought I'd find and see if I could find a quick summary. And I found a really good one. So I was like coffeegroundsinthegarden.edu. Up came University of Arizona Cooperative Extension, their backyard gardener bulletin number 140. And the first thing they cite, Dr. Linda Chalker Scott, Extension Urban Horticulturist, Associate Professor at Washington State University, has explored many garden myths, among them the benefits of coffee grounds in the garden. And they do have advantages. They are, the question that does come up is, will they make the soil more acidic? No, that's not an issue. pH of decomposing coffee grounds range from 4.6 to 8.4. So 7 is neutral. So it was all over the place. Also, changes over time. You should not assume that it will always be acidic. The question was whether they carried any diseases. They do act or prevent any diseases. This was a claim that was being made that you could use coffee grounds as a sort of a natural fungus control. Well, surprisingly, for some soil-borne diseases, coffee grounds do appear to suppress certain fungal rots and wilts, Fusarium, Pythium, Sclerotinia, as well as some bacterial pathogens. So coffee ground compost and mulches actually enhanced germination of some seeds while inhibiting germination of others. So don't just start doing this willy-nilly, but be aware that it could have some benefit. Dr. Chalker Scott has synthesized coffee ground research results to make the following recommendation. In compost, limit coffee ground content to no more than 20% of the total compost volume. More than 30% has often been detrimental. Additions of diverse raw materials to compost should ensure a diversity of microorganisms. Don't assume coffee grounds will make an acidic compost. pH levels will fluctuate over time. In mulch, just putting it on the ground. Since coffee grounds are finely textured and easily compacted, they can create a barrier to moisture and air movement, especially when applied in thick layers. Now, you'd be doing a lot of coffee grounds, but some people were going and getting bucket loads of them every couple of days. So it could reduce penetration of water and air to some degree. Rather than using pure coffee grounds as mulch, try using a thin layer, no more than 1/2 inch of coffee grounds, and cover with a thicker layer of coarse organic mulch. And if you know Dr. Chalker Scott, her favorite coarse organic mulch is arborist wood chips. So they're fine. They do have some nitrogen. They may have some other properties. Don't use too much of them in one place. And one of the simplest things to do, just run them through your compost pile so that they're, you know, any possible adverse effects would be ameliorated by the process of composting.
And if you all out there don't have a compost pile like I don't, I live in the city of Davis where we have a green waste bin where you can put all of your compostable things in. The city will take it away. They'll run it through their compost system, which they do properly. And then at the end, they allow people in Davis to go and pick up compost for
compost,
free.
Compost is a regulated term in the state of California. So to sell something with compost on the label, the manufacturer of that bagged product has to have brought it to a certain internal temperature of the compost pile and provided validation of that to the state of California. For that reason, most bagged goods suppliers won't put the word compost on their label in any way, because it's a regulatory issue. They contain compost, but it isn't actually compost. I do sell, as an example, at my store, a product called organic compost. And I like to joke, that is the most regulated bag I sell. Both the word organic and the word compost are subject to regulations by the state of California. So they had to jump through a bunch of hoops in order to prove that everything that went into that bag was certified organic input material, and that it had actually been brought to a proper temperature for a compost pile. Why? Because that temperature makes sure that pathogens are destroyed, weed seeds for the most part will be destroyed, and proper breakdown of the materials has occurred to the point that you won't get nitrogen tie up when you use it in your garden. So organic compost does meet certain regulatory criteria. What it doesn't have in it is fertilizer. And I've made this point repeatedly when I'll say to someone, oh, well, you know, it sounds like your tomato plants and your raised planter bed just needed more nitrogen last year. And they'll say, oh, fine, I make compost. That isn't providing nitrogen. There's almost nothing that you are putting into your compost pile that provides a source of nitrogen, unless you're putting food scraps or something in there, which most people don't do. Your compost improves the organic content of the soil. It helps retain moisture. It helps retain nutrients, but it does not typically provide them in any significant amount. So adding manure or coffee grounds or things like that can help bump up the nitrogen content somewhat. My mother and father built a house right near UC San Diego in 1950. And one of the first things they planted was a Haas avocado tree several feet from the back door. It was out in the backyard. You could just step out 10 feet and there it was. That tree was there for 62 years. My mom finally had to have it taken out late in her life because it was finally declining. They didn't feed it much at all, but they were old percolator coffee drinkers. So there was a percolator coffee pot going at all times in my household when I was growing up. And once or twice a day, someone would step out the back door, fling the coffee grounds at the avocado tree into roughly the same spot day after day after day for 62 years. And it built up the level, actually. They don't break down that quickly. So they were applying it faster than it was decomposing. They basically never did feed that tree much until its many, many, many later years. And they found that basically using the coffee grounds and the mulch that my father used in the vegetable garden, which probably had some manure in it because he was very characteristically would put that in his compost, that was the only nitrogen it was getting. I would recommend, they didn't really listen to me, but I would recommend that you fertilize it with a citrus avocado fertilizer every now and then. But 62 years was a good enough run. They probably felt they got their money's worth out of that tree.
Thank you to the listeners who send me flower quotes. I do have these two books I'm getting quotes out of, but I always appreciate getting another one. A flower does not think of competing with the flower next to it. It just blooms.
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.
Please welcome our newest program to KDRT Airways, the Yolo Backyard Bulletin, with host Jesse Drew sharing news and views on what's going down in Yolo County. Tune in Thursdays from 5 to 6 p.m. right here on KDRT.